This episode of Motherfuck Lore is brought to you by the show's generous supporters on Patreon. Your support has made it possible for us to keep this show going during quarantine, and this very week it allowed us to put out a video episode about sign language with sign language interpretation and closed captions to make it as accessible as possible. Thank you very much for doing that. Here's the show.
Of Podcast Network, welcome to Motherfuck Lore, a podcast of words, Irish words and words from Ireland. I'm Derek O'Shea. I'm always interested to see how other minority languages survive, thrive, do well, do their things in compared to how Irish is doing. And I was especially fascinated recently. We talk about Duolingo a fair bit in this podcast. And recently, the 40th language to be added to Duolingo is Yiddish. And when I was looking into this, I found something just wonderful that there was a brother-sister team in America have been involved not only in the preparation of the Yiddish course on Duolingo, but also the translation of Harry Potter into Yiddish all happened within the same family. I had to find out more. So I'm delighted today to talk to both of them, Aaron and Mina. I should have clarified to pronounce how you pronounce your name.
Oh, our last name?
Yeah.
You can pronounce it however you want. We usually pronounce it by taking the H at the end and putting it after the S. So Vishwanath.
Arun and Mina Vishwanath. Is that correct?
Yep.
Is it? Go on, you be honest.
Yeah. You have to take away the H at the end.
So, Vishwanath.
But an accent on the first syllable.
Vishwanath. Yeah. Vishwanath. Okay, that's fine. Okay. Arun
like an
and Mina Vishwanath. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Just to clarify, Mina, you've been involved in the Duolingo project, and Aaron, you have translated Harry Potter.
Yes, that's right. And we've both been working with our little sister Malika, who's been she was one of my editors/proofreaders, and she helped Mina. She helped with the Duolingo course as well, right?
Yeah, she helped proofread the sentences for us as well.
Master proofreader.
Fantastic! This is a great family tradition for yourselves, and. So there's a family. You have a family tradition of promoting Yiddish, am I right?
Yes, it goes back a number of generations. In our mother's generation, our mother published an English Yiddish dictionary recently, and is also a Yiddish poet. Our aunt is editor of the Yiddish Forward, their other siblings also have roles in the Yiddish world. As Yiddish teachers and conductor of a Yiddish choir. Go back a generation, our grandfather was a professor of Yiddish at Columbia University, among other universities, and wrote his PhD after World War II in Vienna on declension of Yiddish verbs, if I'm not mistaken. And then even going back a generation before that, his father, our great-grandfather, attended the Yiddish conference in Chernovitz in 1918. Is that right, Arun?
I thought it was 1908. But
1908, no, I'm sorry, you're right, 1908.
Not just attended, he walked there. He walked miles barefoot.
Uphill both ways.
Of course.
I think he did walk there, and I think it was a number of miles.
That is the story I've heard as well. So our family has been very devoted to Yiddish, and one might think, you know, our great grandfather, well, that was back in Europe, so everybody was speaking Yiddish. But in fact, in Chernivtsi and in that area, it actually wasn't cool to speak Yiddish. Everybody was really moving over to German, everybody who was at all cultured. But our great grandfather insisted on maintaining to speak Yiddish. Yeah.
Absolutely. So no pressure on your own kids then.
Yeah, no. my kids do speak Yiddish.
Fantastic. So let's start. I mean, I was listening to an interview with you on the Tikva podcast, and you were talking about the how well the Yiddish module in Duolingo is going. And as the episode is going on, you were giving updates and how many new thousands of people had signed up for it. It's been wonderfully successful.
It has. We are up to 210,000 users now, And there has been amazing feedback on social media, Facebook, Twitter, the Duolingo forums, a lot of response.
It's fantastic. And why do you think that is? Why do you think there's been such a huge engagement?
Well, the course has been in development for 5 years, so I think that definitely helped build the buzz because people have been waiting for a long time. But mostly, I imagine a large portion of those 210,000 active learners are American Jews who have historically a very nostalgic relationship with Yiddish. Yiddish would have usually fallen out of their family 1, 2, 3 generations ago as their families immigrated to the United States and tried to assimilate, fit in, integrate. And many of those families made the decision to adopt English or leave Yiddish behind in order to integrate. And so now a lot of young American Jews, and I think that this phenomenon is not unique to America, but probably the biggest population of these young Jews is in America. So these young Ashkenazi Jews are feeling the lack, feeling the loss. And most of them are nostalgic enough, interested enough to at least pick up a free gamified app and see what all the buzz is about. You know, not all of those 210,000 learners are necessarily going to be nostalgic enough to sit down and work through a grammar textbook or take a proper Yiddish course or speak Yiddish in their family to their kids. But certainly the interest in just experiencing what is all this Yiddish, you know, this language that my grandparents spoke is, and Duolingo just makes it so easy to pick it up.
I think you're right there. I think with nostalgia, the language is something that's experienced with Irish as well. People are interested to hear that words that have an interesting translation, like an escalator being translating literally in Irish as a living stairs or something like that.
For us in Yiddish, escalator is rolling stairs or folding stairs. Yeah,
and that's so visual. And the word in Irish for a jellyfish is smuggler roan, which means a seal snot. And people that's love awesome. That. That's but awesome. Then we say, okay, now look at the past tense of these five verbs. And I see ya. And obviously that seems to be the problem, that people nostalgia can only take you so far. And when we were talking discussing this episode in the group chat before we started recording, something that was very interesting, that struck me as very interesting, is this idea, you both alerted me to something I'd never considered, but it makes so much sense now you've said it, that the idea of Yiddish's kind of, the fact that some people only know Yiddish from certain loan words in maybe New York slang, it has been maybe to the detriment of the actual language, a language where language which has had Nobel Prize winning writers were using it, a huge literary tradition, isolating it down to some funny words for annoying people has been very much to the detriment.
I mean, it's honestly very complicated. The situation of Yiddish as a minority language is very complicated in a number of ways. One, because the mode of loss is not the mode and the extent of loss has really not been uniform. So for some people, that loss was, maybe some people will call this involuntary, but voluntary in an attempt to assimilate. Some was, quite traumatically as a result of the Holocaust or, other traumatic uprootings that happened during World War II. A lot of people had trouble maintaining their language in the various countries that they immigrated to, including Israel. And so what we end up with is a couple of generations later, a big portion of Jews of Eastern European descent who have this deep, deep ambivalence towards Yiddish. And that ambivalence, in my opinion, comes out of a deep sense of loss, mm-hmm. perhaps subconsciously. And so I really struggle with, it sounds like you feel very comfortable, Dara, leading off with these fun words. For me as a Yiddish speaker, I try to distance myself as much as possible because it's sort of like, yeah, that's the, you know, that's not, oftentimes those words aren't even Yiddish. And so, you know, we try to basically say like, that's kind of like Yinglish. That's like Yiddish light. That's not really Yiddish. If you're really interested in Yiddish, you know, take a course, get acquainted with our deep literature. And of course, what makes it even more complicated is that there continues to be a community of organic speakers of Hasidic Jews who continue to speak Yiddish today alongside the Yiddishists who do it for ideological reasons. So it's super complicated alongside a population that's largely apathetic.
Well, I will say that the flip side, you know, ambivalence has two sides, right? So the flip side is that all these articles about, you know, your favorite word in Yiddish and all the jokes and the phrases your grandmother said that you passed down, it helps maintain the interest. You know, if there if there weren't all these articles and listicles every year or so, like, yeah, what's your favorite word? You know, Yiddish would have faded from the Jewish American landscape a lot earlier. So although the Yiddish that people think they know is just little bits and pieces mixed in with just kind of Jewish English, or, you know, or Yinglish, as Erin called it, at the same time, those little bits and pieces are the connection, the spark that could be relit. You know, and if that wasn't there, we wouldn't have 210,000 users on Duolingo.
That's a good point.
Definitely, though. It's a tricky balance to strike. I can see that because there's both arguments make so much sense. So when I if I was going to use look up Irish on Duolingo, there's a little Irish flag there, and then you see then when I understand when non-English speakers are looking for English, there's an American flag, which raises all sorts of questions. And then I think with Spanish, there's a Spanish flag when you're learning Spanish, even though I think the Spanish used is actually Central American Spanish.
Right.
Which, and then, so that this raised an issue about what flag or symbol even should be used for learning Yiddish.
Yeah, I mean, as you point out, Yiddish isn't the first one to have, you know, have to make controversial decisions about the Duolingo course, but the flag certainly was a difficult decision, partially because a flag is such a representative of national identity, and Yiddish speakers don't have a national identity in the same way. You know, they're bound by religion and culture, but not necessarily nationality. You know, you have Yiddish speakers from all different countries around the world. So it's very much an international, transnational language. So what does it mean to make a flag for that kind of language? And of course, another thing is that maybe 100-150 years ago, the experience of a Yiddish speaker would have been more uniform. But now, as Arun said, we're living in a world where some Yiddish speakers, you know, speak Yiddish like we do because our family just never stopped. Some Yiddish speakers speak it because they're Yiddishist and the chain was broken in their family, but they actively learned it and brought it back in their tradition. And then there's this Hasidic Yiddish world and also some ultra-Orthodox non-Hasidim who speak Yiddish because partly as a means of separating themselves from the world. There's just so many different types of Yiddish speakers, and to find one flag that is meaningful to all of them, but also is not too overly broad. Essentially, you know, it's Yiddish is a Jewish language, but it's only one of many Jewish languages. It happens to be the one that's most in the popular consciousness besides Hebrew, but certainly, you know, Duolingo might someday make a Ladino course or some other courses of Jewish languages. So we didn't just want to put a generically Jewish symbol on there, though that would speak to all Yiddish speakers, but it would be too broad. So we set ourselves some pretty tight parameters there to find a symbol. We went through a process that involved opening up the question to the public, putting out a. I know it was.
It was a real shit show.
You know. I have to say, it was a little bit of a shit show. But
sorry, I didn't mean shit show. You handled it very well. I meant shit storm.
Yes.
The difference is significant.
Yes, I would say it was a little bit of both, but I think that it did generate, first of all, attention for the course, but also a very interesting conversation among people on social media, and we got a lot of really interesting suggestions. So we got some very, very bad suggestions, like just put a bagel on it, or...
throw that in the English pile.
Yeah, put a yellow star on it. That was just a no-no. I have to say, I got that suggestion from more than one person.
Oh my god!
I know.
There are two political states where Irish is spoken. There's Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. And if someone said to find a neutral position, use a potato or a pint of Guinness or something, you'd say no thanks.
Right. It's a sign of the relationship that people have to Yiddish, that they don't really often respect it as a language and as a culture, other than, you know, as humor and so forth. So what we ended up settling on was the letter Kumitz Aleph. And so Aleph is the first letter of both the Hebrew and the Yiddish alphabet. The Yiddish uses a modified form of the Hebrew alphabet. Of course, choosing the first letter of the alphabet signifies learning and study, which is of course appropriate for Duolingo. Adding the kumitz is a diacritic that goes underneath the aleph, and it makes it turns it into a vowel that has a sound o or u depending on your dialect. And that combination as a vowel is not used, as far as I know, in any other Jewish language. Though most Jewish languages use a modified form of the Hebrew alphabet, but no language has modified it in exactly the way that Yiddish did. So we felt that Kumitz Aleph as a symbol was unique to Yiddish. And as well, there is a famous Yiddish song. I think it's probably one of the most famous Yiddish songs. It's called Afn Pripichik or Eufn Pripichik.
Doesn't it show up in Schindler's List?
Exactly. It's in the soundtrack of Schindler's List. So most people, even if they don't know the song, will recognize kind of the violin strains when they hear it. In that song, the song essentially is a scene of a teacher, a Rebbe, sitting with his young students, probably 4, 5, 6 years old. They're sitting by the fireplace, he is teaching them the alphabet. And the way the alphabet is taught in traditional schools, you'd say Pasach Aleph, Ah, Kumitz Aleph, O, and you know, just kind of say the name of the letter and then sound it out and build that muscle memory. And so in the song, he's teaching them Kumitz Aleph, O. And so it's just a very evocative phrase for those who know the song. And the song, of course, because it's a Yiddish song, it can't just be about kids and teacher. It's a metaphor for the Jewish experience, and he's telling them how, you know, these letters hold within them the entirety of Jewish tradition and experience and so forth. So we just felt it was
Jewish tears.
And you Jewish know, tears, of course.
A little bit of optimism in there.
Jewish suffering. So that's what we settled on. And surprisingly enough, no one is strongly against it. Many people are like, that's okay, you know, cool. But like, you know, that's the best I could ask for.
So much thought went into that compared to just sticking a flag on. It's like the amount of thought there and the fact that the letter had this like diacritic that maybe not everyone would appreciate and the significance of the song and everything, that's people should appreciate that more.
Yes, well,
hopefully they will after you listen to us today.
I had to make a defensible decision, you know, because I knew whatever decision we made, people would come after us. So at least this way, I have a good story.
Oh yeah, God, no, it's. And you mentioned a word there, which always brings up a smile to my face: dialect. I mean, I'm sure everyone just accepted. Yeah, just pick whatever dialect you like. No one's gonna object to that, right?
Yeah, no, that was probably even more controversial than the flag question.
So there are multiple dialects of Yiddish, and with different levels of, I guess, prestige or access or cachet. And same way that when in the Irish course in Duolingo, there's significant differences between Donegal Irish, Munster Irish, and Connacht Irish, and somebody just had to pick one and run with it. Similar dilemmas were faced.
Yes, very much so. Yiddish has, I would say, the Yiddish that we speak nowadays, which is generally Eastern Yiddish, has three main sub-dialects: Northeastern, Central, and Southeastern. And those descriptions are all representative of where everyone lived in Europe. Now, of course, most Yiddish speakers don't live in Eastern Europe anymore, so that adds another layer of complexity on top of it. But there are certainly cultural meaning attached to these various dialects. The Northeastern dialect being the more perhaps educated and humorless and dry dialect. The Central dialect stereotypically being what we in America might consider a Southern dialect, a little bit more of a drawl, a lot of diphthongs, and maybe associated with a little bit more lower class, and then the Southeastern dialect used in theater.
Isn't it extraordinary that it seems every country in the world has this division between kind of humorless Northerners and laid-back Southerners, and it even happens in landlocked countries when the north of one country is the border of the south of one country, suddenly it's still transcribes. I mean, like, it's
right.
Like, if you think that, yes, some that a North Italian is practically a Southern Swiss person, but the northernness and southernness still kick through.
Yes. Yeah. So on top of that, we have layered the fact that very few of us live in Eastern Europe anymore, and so each of these dialects has also attained certain cultural contexts in the modern world. So the northern Lithuanian Yiddish is often still associated with the university and educated folk, partially because there is a standardized dialect of Yiddish, which was standardized for use as a kind of trans dialect, you know, across dialects, and also to be taught, used in education. And that one is at least it sounds closest to the northern dialect. So that's the one that's taught in most universities and courses nowadays, and contrasted with the central dialect, which, you know, in Europe had this association with being lower class. In the United States, that's the dialect that is spoken most by the Hasidim, the ultra Orthodox, who also they are kind of closed off and don't interact and certainly could be stereotyped in various different ways by outsiders, and so choosing that dialect was a statement. So and then there's the Southeastern dialect, which is actually what Arun and I speak. but the arguments for and against are very much boiled down to the Yiddishist community versus the Hasidic community for the most part. I mean, broadly speaking, the Northern dialect was pushed by the Yiddishists and by those who are in the universities and Yiddish educators, because it is the one taught in universities. So Duolingo would then become a tool that could be used in classes and universities without much adaptation. And as well, pedagogically, it's the most consistently pronounced with respect to the spelling.
Yes.
However, the Hasidic Yiddish, which is mostly draws from Central Yiddish, Polish and Hungarian Yiddish, is probably the one most spoken by native Yiddish speakers nowadays, mostly because the Hasidim are so, they close out the outside world, so they still have lots of native speakers, even monolingual speakers. And their families are quite large. They have 8, 10, 12 children per family. So they're certainly the fastest growing dialect. And so to choose that was to make a claim about the vitality and the living nature of Yiddish, that we're choosing the dialect that is that is most in active use, regardless of what's taught in the university. So it's kind of the ivory tower versus the streets discussion, and a big factor in our discussion as well was that most of the team. So that there were a number of other team members, and almost all of them came from the Hasidic world and were native speakers of this Hasidic dialect. So yeah.
So, speaking of, obviously, the university tradition and the literary tradition in Yiddish, this kind of brings us to the bridge a little bit. Isaac Bashevis Singer, am I pronouncing Bashevis right?
Yes.
Close enough. Well, thank you. He obviously won a Nobel Prize for literature and gave his four works written in Yiddish, and gave a speech in Yiddish, and in which he remarked, and I believe this is a hotly contested statement, that there are no words for weapons in the language. And I brought this up in the group chat. You're like, nope, wrong, so wrong. If he was wrong, he stuck it in right.
I mean, you know, Mina was talking about statements of vitality, but it's certainly a statement about the statelessness of Yiddish. You know, the fact that certainly throughout most of the time the Jews were in Eastern Europe, Yiddish was by no means a state-funded language. And so I guess you could make the argument that because Jewish society itself didn't have, weaponry and it wasn't a part of their daily landscape, they were, you could argue that there is no native word in Yiddish. But, you know, of course, at some point they borrowed words for this because Jews, like everybody else, were pressed into the army service under the Russian Tsar. And there were many, many, many Yiddish-speaking people who were using weapons, often not by their own volition, but they certainly had words for them. I'm curious what you think he was getting at with that.
I thought it was interesting because it's I guess it sounds very. He was saying this in the mid-70s, and maybe it felt quite groovy and right on to say, yeah, my language is really, is inherently peaceful and loving because it doesn't have these bad words for mean things.
Right. Yiddish was always a language of the oppressed, never of the oppressor. That's another trope that I've heard.
But isn't it interesting because then you think that at one point, once a loan word is in there, it's in there.
Right.
I mean, how long does a loan word have to be in a language before, it's fully accepted? And it's, I know that people like say things like that, the word crack. We talk about having good crack in Irish, and people say, well, crack technically came from, from like English or Scottish, and it was just used differently. But then we think, well, at some point you gotta say, yes, it's been in our language as long as we've been using text as a verb. So,
Right. Jews have a long memory.
but even more so in Yiddish, because Yiddish is a language that was formed out of other languages. It's I think it's called a Schmelzsprach. It just kind of take little bits of lots of languages and just meld them all together. And so Yiddish has a very strong tradition of borrowing words from wherever people lived for whatever they wanted to express. In fact, one of the biggest vocabulary differences between the different dialects are for food and the natural world, because they would use whatever words were being used around them and incorporate that word into their Yiddish. So, I mean, absolutely. If you asked me today, I could tell you several words for various weapons, and I would not be able to tell you what the source language is, which to me says that means they're Yiddish.
Fair enough. I think, yeah, if you don't know the source language, that makes sense. They belong to Yiddish then. So from weapons to wands and broomsticks and so forth, Harry Potter has been translated to so many languages, and Aaron, you translated the Harry Potter. How many of the have you translated to Yiddish so far?
So far, just the Philosopher's Stone. The second one is I'm in the middle of it, but a baby is stopping me from finishing it. So slowly.
They're terrible like that.
So needy.
Oh God, yeah. And I'm trying to write my third book, and I've got these two children demanding to be fed and washed and
unbelievable.
And attention paid, but what can you do? But I was just looking there at some interviews you've done in respect of translating Harry Potter into Yiddish and the amount of factors taken on board, I thought it, again, dialect is something that's always interesting, I suppose, as one maybe jumping off point. The idea, let's say, how, first of all, I suppose, actually, before we get into dialect, and Hagrid speaking with a, like a Polish variation instead of an, a West England kind of variant, when Harry Potter was translated into Irish, certain words were kept in English for various reasons, because they were thinking it was, well, a lot of people who were going to be reading it were going to be people who spoke English as a first language, learning Irish or had school Irish, and having certain English words there for Ravenclaw or Quidditch might help people along and as little signifiers to keeping people marching along. But you did translate some of those terms.
Yeah, I generally was trying to avoid creating fan fiction, and so
yeah.
I wanted to recreate the experience that I know I myself had reading Harry Potter in English, and I think there may be, to the extent that in the Irish translation, certain terms were kept to keep it a little bit easier for the reader. Fortunately for Yiddish, being a dramatic language and being so similar to English, for an American Jew who knows some Hebrew, Yiddish is probably the easiest language for them to learn.
Yeah.
And so while I do think that Harry Potter is actually an amazing pedagogical tool for those who are interested in Yiddish and who are interested in something that's not necessarily a beginner's text, but that they might know by heart because they've read it so many times, I did feel like I had to translate some terms that just seemed like they were begging to be done, or that couldn't really be done in Yiddish because of the, or couldn't be done with the original because of the sound symbolism or the pun that existed in the original.
I loved how you resolved the translation of Quidditch itself. You found a proverb, I suppose, in respect of when God finds a way, the broom flies.
Yeah, people were a little bit upset that I didn't just call it Quidditch because, I don't know, you could probably imagine how some people are like, oh, that sounds like a good Yiddish word, Quidditch, Quidditch. It almost rhymes with Yiddish. And the truth is I didn't really have to translate it, but while I was walking and I was like, I feel like there's something that has to do with brooms in Yiddish. It sounds familiar. And then I remembered it was one of the first books of Yiddish poetry that I had read. And it was basically a stanza describing something, one miraculous that could happen. And as you say, the phrase in Yiddish was, as Gott will, schießt der Besen, if God wills it, even a broom can shoot or perhaps can sprout. And so...
look at that, a word for a weapon in Yiddish.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. And so it seemed perfect for a sport where, you fly around on brooms and try to shoot things into hoops. So I just took the parts of the aphorism that meant shoot and broom and put them together. And so for Quidditch, we got Schießbesen, shoot broom.
Fantastic. What did you call the houses?
Oh, yeah, that was fun. Well, Hufflepuff stayed the same. That one, I agree. That's just a perfect Yiddish word. Ravenclaw was pretty straightforward. I just took the word for raven and the word for claw. And so we got Robbenkrell. For Gryffindor, I knew that the etymology, because there's these wikis online where you can see all the other ways that other languages solve this, and I tried not to lean on them too much, but I immediately realized that Gryffindor was from the French, or seems to be from the French, Griffin d'or, of gold, so a griffin of gold, and so I just inverted it and in Yiddish got golden griff. But then when it came to Slytherin, there wasn't really any good solution where I could kind of just move things around and rehash it, because the word Slither itself, of course, is an English word, and the pun is on the snake being the motto for the mascot for Slytherin House. And also because the eth sound doesn't exist in Yiddish. And it's a phonetic alphabet, not written in the English alphabet. So, I couldn't well just go and reproduce the TH. And I didn't want to do Slytherin because, ugh, I don't know. That would be too lazy. So I thought, how can we preserve the shape of the word and also maintain the symbolism to the snake? And then it hit me that the word in Yiddish for venom is sam, and the word for inside or therein is derin. And so we got sam derin, which kind of sounds like Slytherin and literally means venom therein, or there is poison inside. So it seemed appropriate reference to the basilisk.
Fantastic. The book has received positive feedback on the translation so far.
It was pretty cool. I didn't have my hopes set too high because, you know, it's a Yiddish book and it's my translation, so I don't want to be disappointed. But of course, also it's Harry Potter, right? So you have people who are buying every single translation of Harry Potter that's out there, just plain old collectors. Then you have native Yiddish speakers, even people within the Hasidic community who are not quite as... who are not quite as insular as we might think and whose fringes are much more porous than we would expect, who are buying this book, many of whose kids had maybe even read the book in English, which is really quite amazing. And so there were those people who were buying the book. And of course, most Yiddishists, I think, had to get a copy. You had this broad swath of Jews of Eastern European descent who seemed to have just bought the book to have it on their shelves.
The nostalgia factor again.
Yeah, which I mean, I think that's amazing. What they say, what's on your bookshelf says a lot about you, and the fact that people bought it to have it on their bookshelf, even if they have absolutely zero intent of ever reading it, to me is
it's the downstairs bookshelf, not the upstairs bookshelf then, yeah?
They didn't tell me which one. Okay, I'll have to go and do an audit.
I think they say the downstairs bookshelf is the one you want kind of visitors of the house to see, and the stairs ones, the ones you're actually reading in bed.
That's fantastic.
And yeah, it's just I remember when The Simpsons is translated into German, there's a German character called Uder, and he becomes Swiss in the German translation. And when The Simpsons is translated into Italian, the kind of the mobsters become Sicilians instead of just speaking kind of standard Italian. And I was wondering how dialects played a factor in the fact in when you're translating a book like Harry Potter into Yiddish, when certain characters have Scottish accents or West Country accents, or these are familiar from the films, as well as from the dialect itself.
Yeah, it was kind of like the perfect confluence of factors. The fact that Yiddish itself is known to have a number of dialects, and everybody's always clamoring, for their dialect to be recognized. And the fact that the original clearly had at least one person clearly speaking a dialect, right? Hagrid is speaking some sort of West Country accent, which is apparent from all of the apostrophes. And Mina already introduced us to some of these caricatures that are mapped onto the dialects, where you have the northern type who's, we'll start with the Polish or the central type, who is maybe lower class, maybe a little bit more, has a sense of humor, is really quite easy to get along with. And so I thought, okay, well, that's perfect for Hagrid. Let's just have him speaking a central accent.
And they also drop their consonants and have very broad vowels.
They also drop their consonants. So it was perfect because I was able to like reproduce all the apostrophes. And if we had a person speaking the central dialect, well, then they need somebody in opposition to them. So who's Hagrid's sworn enemy? Well, there's a couple of people he doesn't like, but of course Filch is one. And so I had him speaking like a very, very like backwater northern dialect, which isn't much spoken today. And then I also had Snape and Professor McGonagall speaking somewhat more refined versions of the northern dialect. And so it was a really great opportunity also for students. You know, we're talking about pedagogical possibilities. It was a great way to get students acquainted with the various dialects so that, you know, people might complain, oh, well, you use the academic orthography. But, you know, I did try to reflect the variety of Yiddish that exists, although you can't really please everybody.
You certainly can't, and trying always ends in tears.
I always say I feel good about the dialect that Duolingo picked, because we have people complaining from all sides. If we only had complaints from one side, we clearly didn't come to a good compromise.
Exactly. That's fantastic. So, I mean, and what? So what do you both have next after? I mean, these have been two very successful projects. What's the next plan for promotion of Yiddish? Is more translating more books?
I've already finished half of the second book. So that should be exciting. You know, we'll get to reveal what the Yiddish anagram of I Am Lord Voldemort is. Mm-hmm. I hope that we'll be able to do an audiobook. To me, aside from just selfishly, you know, wanting to do this because I love it, I really think the pedagogical possibilities are amazing. And having an audiobook that people can just listen to, especially because there's many people who did hear Yiddish in their youth, but they never learned the Hebrew alphabet. And they're not about to go learn it, you know, at age 60 or 70. And so for them to have an audiobook would be amazing. So I did record the first chapter, and it's on YouTube, where people can hear like Hagrid and McGonagall and Dumbledore all doing their thing. But I do hope that we'll have a professionally made audiobook with a professional voice actor at some point.
Alter über unken Menia.
Ja, Sir. Von Hause geblieben ist mein wie ein Churwe. Noch haben wir rausgeraten, wird eines ist ein ungekommener Machen des Muggeln. Riss angeschlufen, beschassen sie mir geflogen über Bristol.
Dumbledore und der Professorin McGonagall haben sich angebeugen über den Peckel Koldriklach.
Before we wrap up, there was want to tell me about Sean Ferguson.
Should we tell the joke?
Please.
Mina, do you want to tell this?
Sure. So a guy is coming over from Europe. He's on a boat to New York, and his name is let's say Moshe Cohen, and he's just a very Jewish name, and he knows when he comes to the New World he doesn't want to have a Jewish name anymore. He wants to, you know, integrate, become American. And so his brother, who's already made it to New York before him, writes him a letter and tells him, okay, when you get to Ellis Island, you need to tell the guy that your name is Michael Smith. So he's on the boat, and he's telling himself, Michael Smith, I have to remember, Michael Smith. He's just repeating it to himself over and over and over again. Finally, he sees the Statue of Liberty. He arrives in Ellis Island. He comes to the clerk who's going to write down all of his information, and the clerk says, all right, name? And he gets so flustered, he forgets. He says, oi, schon vergessen, I've already forgotten. So the clerk writes down, Sean Ferguson.
That's fantastic. So basically, if there are people, listeners out there called Sean Ferguson, your name is I've forgotten. Mina and Aaron, thank you so much for taking the time to chat to me today. It's been absolutely fascinating. I think we probably could talk for another hour or so, but at some point, people need to go to sleep and go to bed. And I appreciate you giving your time so much, and I wish you both so much luck and success with the next stage of your projects. Mina, you are smart enough to stay off social media. Am I right? But where?
I am on Facebook. I don't have a Twitter account, but I am on Facebook. Yes.
Good stuff. But where can people find out more about your work?
I think the best way is to go to duolingo.com and sign up for the Yiddish course. I'd love to have you be learner 210,001.
Fantastic. Aaron, where can people find out more about your work?
Twitter is probably the best place. I field a lot of incoming complaints for Duolingo. People want me to pass it along to my sister, and I say, no, that's not what I do. Mm-hmm. I'll argue with you, though, if you want. My handle is A_A_my last name, which is VISWANATH. A_A_Vishwanath.
I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Oh, awesome.
Thank you so much again. So until the next time, Slán go fóill.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode of Motherfuck Lore. We come out every Friday on the Headstuff Podcast Network. Having said that, we will be finishing the season next week with an episode Bialtina special episode about fatal deviation and its unique place in Irish culture. Thank you very much to Brian for doing the production. Thank you to Kirsten Scheele for doing the artwork. Thank you to the backroom team at Headstuff for everything they do. If you're looking for more shows, Headstuff have a wide range of entertaining shows and informative shows. One of my favorites is The Wonderful World of Wikipedia, which is just back for its second season right now. If you wish to contact the show, you can do so using the WhatsApp number in our show notes. We'd love to get some voice notes from you. You can support Motherfucker on Patreon at patreon.com/Tarok. Even though we're closing up shop for the summer on the main feed, we will be still releasing new episodes, hopefully every fortnight throughout the summer, which will be Patreon only. So if you'd like to keep the fire lit, that's how you do it. In the meantime, stay safe, mind yourselves, and much love.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
I'm calling it for Sweden. I'm calling this is Max Martin's contribution to the English language.
Okay. That's right, me.